This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, listeners. This is Jeff, reading from the publication After Dinner Conversation. This week's story is entitled SMRTSS, and it's written by Patrick Tibbetts. And just sort of an introduction on this to make it a little bit clearer. It took me reading it a couple times before it made sense to me, but there are actually three different time segments in this story. It starts out in Vietnam during the Vietnam conflict. Then there is a short part that takes place between then and now, and then we move into current time. SMRTSS is an acronym for something which will be revealed by the end of the story. So here we go. SMRTSS by Patrick Tibbetts. In the dim, wet oven of the Huey's troop compartment, the corporal sat on a flak jacket behind the sweat-stained backs of the first squad. Sims, the big machine gunner from Fire Team 2, leaned back against him, jamming the corporal's knees right up to his chest and pressing him and the radio on his back against the rear bulkhead. The corporal rode with the Black Horse, the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. Though Sims and the chopper's noise and the hot heavy air and the funk of unwashed men all pressed down upon him, as did the leaden dread of what was to come, he was proud of his unit. His AN-PRC-25 radio, known as the PRIC-25, lacked frequency hopping or voice encryption, so the combat net was broadcast in clear. The handset at his ear tied him to bearing and range instructions as the Huey was vectored into the loading zone. He yelled over the thudder of the rotor, calling out to the sergeant when they were a click out. The skids met the grassy LZ with a jolt. It sickened him as much from a belly-dropping burst of anxiety as from the impact of the chopper's swift descent. Before the first trooper could get to the doorway, a club he didn't see hit the corporal in the head, a shockwave of a blast too loud to hear. The sturdium aluminum shell of the helicopter ruptured as easily as popping a giant balloon, leaving the entire length of the fuselage open to the sky. More shockwaves washed over him as he tried to claw through the metal floor, and though he heard nothing of the ongoing thunder, he knew the entire LZ was getting hit. When he came back to himself and pushed his way from under Sims' heavy, warm carcass, there were no other men in the Huey. Torsos and gut piles and limbs lay tangled in a dark red pool that slopped across the entire deck. A metallic stink hit him. He scrambled for the handset and wiped it on his thigh. He put it to his ear, knowing he would hear nothing. He blew heavily after each statement, struggling to get his breath. "This is Alpha 6 Romea. They hit us at touchdown. Concentrated fire. Heavy mortars. No ranging shots. The LZ was dialed in." At the beginning of his fourth repetition, a rifle muzzle appeared through the riven metal overhead, silhouetted against the hot, white sky. The son of a bitch lives somewhere in this block. Colby Larkin pulled over at the corner and leaned to reread the street sign through the passenger side window. From the passenger seat, he took up an envelope of a dull gray-green hue that marked it as government stationery and withdrew an 8x11 photo. He checked the address scrawled on the back of the photo and let it fall face up onto the seat. An aging man peered up at him, bald but for the graying unkempt tufts over his ears, his ruddy scalp like a road scraped through a wasteland of scrub. This might be the guy. As Colby studied the headshot, he held each of his right-hand fingers in turn, pushing back its cuticle with his left thumbnail. Rage lived a millimeter beneath his skin. He leaned back, took a deep breath, and ran his palm over his close-cropped head. Then the grimy Ford Taurus rolled slowly along a street near empty of parked vehicles on this cloudy mid-morning in this neighborhood of big old trees and little plumbers and carpenters and teachers' homes behind neat lawns. Some were bordered at the house wall by those very dark, low evergreens he had disliked since encountering a wolf spider as a six-year-old. It was on his sixth birthday, and he had run crying to his father, who said that when he was six, they told him his own dad was never coming back. So why didn't he take a stick to the damn spider and be glad he could do it? To his left, the house number appeared in black metallic numerals on a one-story white ranch, where the siding cried out for paint and a lawn of hummocky grass poked through sodden brown leaves. Colby's father had so rarely shown strong emotion. The incident started his inquiry into how things happened, how the world worked, a guidepost for his next three decades. Life on a pig farm offered few answers. Only after leaving for the army, ignoring his parents' despair, did he understand the slackness of his father's lower face and realize the sadness that this quiet and dutiful man had carried. His iPhone lay in a desk drawer back at the agency offices, and the venerable Taurus, picked out of a long-term airport lot, had no GPS. He drove on by and down to the end of the block, where he again read the street sign in case the first had been turned by vandals. It would not do to make a mistake. A U-turn around the intersection took him idling back the way he had come to park at the curb. He grabbed the envelope. Clammy late October air embraced him as he unfolded from the car into gray light seeping through the overcast. A burnt orange Dodge Dart squatted dispiritedly on the cracked concrete drive, its tires low and its finish badly needing the approaching rain. Without stopping, he slipped a hand into the rear wheel well and pocketed the gritty magnetic lozenge he withdrew. On the small cement porch elevated two steps above the walkway, reading the house number one more time, he checked for lenses peering at him from above or through the door. It looked all clear, and he rang the bell. Though his speech and culture were those of a hog farmer's son, the army had promoted, commissioned, and finally educated him. Colby chose a math minor, and after a number theory lecture peppered by his questions, the professor asked him what he thought of the integer 1729. At the next class, he recruited Colby into the agency. At his second ring, the face in the photo peeked around the corner of the door. Same long nose, jowls, and weak jawline. But the tufts over the ears were actually the roots of a ponytail that pulled a ratty graying fringe back away from the landing strip atop his head. This rough, reddish flesh of his scalp looked irritated, maybe even infected. Sweet Jesus, nothing goes rancid like a flower child past its shelf life. The old stoner squinted as he took in Colby's close-cut dark brown hair, pug Irish nose, office wear gray suit, and black shoes. Colby got the badge out, its gold gleaming against a dark brown leather wallet. It was effort to keep from rolling his eyes as he spoke. "Mr. Fierce Lee Human, I'm here about your Freedom of Information Act request. May I come in?" The roomy eyes opened up and the slack mouth dropped slightly open. I'm Professor Human. I mostly go by F. Lee now," saying it F. Lee, or just Lee. F. Lee stood there a moment longer with his mouth slightly ajar, and then slowly broke into a yellow-toothed grin. So the government's caving? It's about time they paid some attention. His vest of light brown leather was worn shiny and stained dark at its edges. right where he grasped a lapel in each hand and held the vest proudly out away from his bare, bony chest and sagging midriff. Mr. Human stood, content to savor the moment. Colby asked again if he might come in. Colby kept a couple yards distance as they walked into the dimness and sour air of the living room. A creepy crawler could leap at you if you got too close. On the coffee table, a litter of crinkled and blackened tinfoil squares glinted dully, and the blackburn marks of recreational alchemy scored the table's rim. Mustiness breathed up as Colby settled onto a bare, spotted, wine-red velvet couch. He laid the green envelope on the table. F. Lee crowed, "Well, it looks like this calls for a celebration. I'll be right back." As he turned, he gave a peculiar toss of his head, a slight twist as he threw it back, full of pride and displaying his hair to advantage. Colby hadn't seen a ponytail flounce like that since the night he had endured a Greenpeace veteran's long-winded tale of daring aboard the Rainbow Warrior. Colby knew far more than he wanted about stoners. An astonishing number could not under a simple declarative sentence without interrupting every phrase with the irrelevant, like... As Mr. Fierce Lee Human strode from the room, Colby recalled from the file that he was north of 60 years old. He looked yet older, his limbs thinned to debilitation, his pot belly sagging, and his face running like candle wax. Human taught journalism at a branch campus of the state university. His qualifications were sketchy, no advanced degrees, a single publication, yet his courses were oversubscribed, drawing flocks of foreign graduate students, a font of out-of-state tuition money in a parched humanities department. All seemed above suspicion until you recalled that every Chinese citizen was required, under pain of imprisonment, to cooperate with the Ministry of State Security. Human, in the guise of spreading his news-gathering techniques to the mainland of China, was running a little Ellis Island for the MSS. A bookcase stood near the front door, and on the wall above its shelves was the poster, handsome Che Guevara in his stylish beret and long wavy hair. And on top shelf was Mao's little red book. Moments later, displayed on the coffee table on a filigreed but tarnished silver tray, lay two loosely rolled joints, their seams still wet with spittle. Colby said, nothing for me, thank you. We're not allowed to do psychoactives on duty. Which would have been true if Colby was in fact on duty. Well, you don't mind, do you, since it's like perfectly legal? Which it was not at the federal level, but Colby's three-letter agency was not DEA. He said he did not want the side stream smoke. F. Lee shrugged and lit up anyway, dragging deep and holding it as he followed Colby's glance over to the poster. The exhale filled the air above him with skunky, translucent smoke. Hey, you a Che fan? The education of the execution wall, man, funny guy. Che. Peruvian academics preached shining path in the guise of philosophy, while Che Guevara led unlettered peasants to kill entire villages. Agency-trained counter-terrorists killed him long before Colby signed on. Surprised that a leftist would mention the communist martyr's early role as Castro's chief executioner, Colby shook his head. Nah, not a Mao fan either. F. Lee dragged again at the joint. Man, you should have a hit. Tune in. That little red book really resonates. And Colby said, I've got to admit, Shannon Path believed it. So did the Khmer Rouge. Maybe they were stoners. You know, the Reds get a lot of bad press, Human said. As Human took another hit and grinned lazily, Colby said, "Well, I think journalists suffer from a poor sense of smell. Stalin and Mao were visionaries if you could ignore the bodies rotting in the fields." Human scowled at him through thickening gray air, the weed talking now. "Yeah, you're just a cop. What the hell do you know?" His research on Human revealed old money and a legacy admission to an Ivy League journalism program. There, a gust front of psychedelics and pot and liberation theology had filled the ringing mental vacuum of the young, malleable, and excitable Henry Williston, creating the undistinguished journalism school graduate and walking echo chamber who took to calling himself Mr. Fierce Lee Human. Colby said, "I know the French-educated Khmer Rouge killed a quarter of Cambodia." Human said, Yeah, none of that was true communism." "Well, perhaps if they'd killed the whole country, they could have achieved purity." Human said, And your accent, redneck." Another ad hominem. Last resort of the cafe radical. Coming not just from a small town, but from the hardscrabble farm country outside a small town. Colby's 20 years old before he heard accent pronounced with two rather than three syllables. The Army had sent Colby to State College, which awarded him high honors. The recognition was not needed. He had better qualifications. Tests graded pass-fail in terms of survival. He waited for Human to realize that he would not reply. Human squinted against the smoke from the remnant of the joint. He looked away from Colby's steady stare and around the room as if he sought an exit. Finally he said, You should get some of that radical freshman pussy, those little flowers ready to give it all for the cause. I was a heavy swinging dick in the movement." Colby nodded. "Well, ideology has its uses." Did Human ever spend time straight? First law freaked him. It only has to make sense to him. Corollary, you can't argue with brain damage. Time to bring this home. "Well, the matter at hand is your request," said Colby. "Is this the material you wanted?" F. Lee took up the dull green envelope and drew out a pair of photographs. In the first, half a dozen old two-blade Huey troop carriers in olive drab were lined out across a flat expanse of knee-high emerald green shoots that Colby knew to be rice plants. Grunts were ducking into the side door of the nearest machine. The other photo was a rear quarter close-up of one of the soldiers, who carried a backpack radio. The details sufficed to read the patch on his shoulder, a rearing coal-black stallion on a shield cut diagonally into fields of red and white. Human said, "Well, this'll show him I was really there." Colby reached out to the coffee table and tapped the photograph. "That's an arrow rifle platoon of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the Black Horse, saddling up for a search and destroy mission." He went on, "You recognize this photo?" There was no inquiry in his tone. Human shrugged. Yeah, it's one of mine." He tilted his head left, right, saying, "Independent journalism at its finest," as the ponytail rustled. Colby tapped the photo harder. "This picture never made the papers." And then he told a perfectly legal lie. "You used your cover as a journalist to watch that search and destroy mission launch through a telephoto lens beside a Russian spy." Human's red eyes went wide. "You couldn't possibly know about that," he said. The shock of that was a pop, like stumbling into an electric fence. This was the guy. Did he realize he had just made an admission of guilt? What was he using for brains? Colby went on. "Everyone remembers 9/11. Do you recall what happened on 11/9? Human's brows went up again. 9th of November? Fuck you! That's what happened. November 9, 1989. The Berlin Wall came down. The Soviets gave up. The Russians even opened their classified archives to Western agencies. Colby went on, this photo is in that archive. Attributed to Henry Williston, an American freelance journalist. You were a Soviet agent. So what? Well, what are you, an American agent? No, I'm an intelligence officer. Human swallowed, gazing at Colby. He looked away to drag at the joint lazily. On the exhale, he said, well, what's the difference? An intelligence officer recruits agents. So what does the agent do? He's the guy who betrays his country. F.L. Human had himself been photographed leaving a meeting of the Communist Party of the USA, whose membership had dwindled to 3,000. Photographed by Colby, who had slapped a tracker beneath the fender of what he had hoped was the world's only burnt orange Dodge Dart. American communists had a rich history of revealing American secrets. But making a Freedom of Information Act or a FOIA request for a copy of the evidence to show off to your comrades was breathtakingly stupid. It suggested a mysterious cerebral deficit, like the effect of syphilis on the brain. The dials on that soldier's radio, the frequencies set just before the launch, are clearly legible in your photo, Mr. Human. Those troopers are dead. Human said, the North Vietnamese Army killed those fuckers, not me. Colby said, yeah, the NVA were trained, disciplined soldiers. Soldiers fight for their unit. Human's ruddy scalp head swayed, the grizzled ponytail tick-tocking like a clock's pendulum across the back of the slick leather vest. He sneered. The fuck I care about a pack of baby killers. They didn't arrest Jane Fonda. Can't arrest me. His eyes went wide in a glare meant to be in itself a meaningful argument. Colby was sure Miss Fonda knew there was no statute of limitations on treason. The corner of his mouth pulled back. Something was wrong inside his head, but this creepy old freak was right. The openly socialist chairman of the Senate Budget Committee would kill funding for the agency's counterintelligence programs if they locked up one of his pets. If he took direct action against Human, Colby risked being fired, prosecuted as a rogue, and imprisoned, all to protect the agency. Was Human a dupe? Entirely stupefied by smoke? What was he coerced? You know, the Mossad had asked Iranian pilots to defect with their aircraft. They killed the ones that said no. Human said, I need exactly one phone call to make you go away. Of course. You can contact your congressman anytime, or a lawyer. Now, my contacts include people much heavier than that, and they don't forget. There it was. Power from the barrel of a gun. Human's students were not eager young lemmings fed on theories of social justice. They were pros, and Human was in their chain of command. Colby said, yeah, I'm sure you're a big fan of FOIA, making the acronym rhyme with soya. You must know that Congress passed it because they were worried about that Eisenhower was mistreating communists. But my favorite program is SMRTSS, an operation I cooked up myself. F. Lee began nodding. He said, yeah, FOIA. Then he squinted. Smartass? There's a secret program called Smartass? Yeah. In fact, Colby had just thought up the acronym. He spelled it out. The red-rimmed, watery glaze narrowed further. Crafty, another secret revealed. So what's SMRTSS? Well, you might call it a side benefit of my job, Colby said. As he spoke, he stood from the couch, snorting to clear the particulates that had migrated up his nose. Humans stood as well, brushing ash from his vest and jeans. He said, petulant. Yeah, but acronyms stand for something. I want to know what it means. Colby brushed back his suit coat and slowly withdrew the pistol at his hip. It was an uncomfortable weapon to carry, extending through the open-ended holster down his pant leg. The suppressor just kept coming, as if the silvery length of the baton was sprouting from his side. F. Lee's jaw dropped, leaving his mouth a dark cavern of disbelief. This didn't happen in America, no matter how toxic you made yourself. Colby looked at Human along the stainless steel cylinder. A person with a gun pointed at them ought to dodge, duck, run, but they barely did, frozen by that ever-expanding black hole which quickly became the center of everything. He waited for the ancient, awful knowledge, the blackness that must not be, to seep into Human's head. At last, the brows drew inward and the lower eyelids crept up, the face about to crumple, the wailing and begging about to begin. Colby said, SMRTSS. Simply murder the stupid shit. And thwump, thwump, the .22 caliber automatic put a round red hole and then another into F. Lee's inflamed-looking forehead. The scrawny body folded and hit the dark brown carpet with a clump, raising another cloud of dust. Stretched, belly up, the old hippie went stiff, shook with an ongoing full-body tremor that looked terribly strenuous. Headshots were tricky. They generally ended organized thought. But unless you hit the brainstem, life could go on. Colby centered up the Smith & Wesson on the tuft of long graying hairs at F. Lee's breastbone. Two rounds there would destroy the heart, stop all blood flow, and still the tremor, bringing peace to the body of F. Lee Human. Human continued to quiver, and at each exhale moaned from low down in his diaphragm. Colby had heard men die, and he wasn't sure if Human was dying. He weighed the mindless animal suffering in Human's cries against the sadness through which his father had moved. A lifetime of sadness. He lifted his finger from the trigger and carefully safed his weapon. I let the old creep tremble. The spider stick went back into its holster. He took care slipping the photos back into the envelope. They were the only ones he had of his grandfather in uniform. Extrajudicial. Unsanctioned. He wasn't sure how he felt. When was justice not revenge? When was guilt more than fear of punishment? One thing he didn't feel was sad. He threw open the front door. Light and air flooded in, cool and clean. Well, listeners, that's the end of today's story. Kind of disturbing on so many levels. So let's look at the discussion questions. What, if any, are appropriate times for extrajudicial killings? Is Colby justified for his extrajudicial killing in this story? And also, I think you might want to ask, what actually do they mean by an extrajudicial killing? What's your definition of it? Secondly, is killing in pursuit of a better future, as F. Lee says he helped with in the past, ever justified? Is there a moral difference between being a spy in support of communism and a spy in support of ending communism? Thirdly, Is all justice a type of state-sanctioned revenge? What is the difference between justice and revenge? You know, I think you might also need to ask, what is justice? You know, and maybe ask yourself this, when have you ever seen justice happen? How about this one? Colby called F. Lee a cafe radical. Now, what does that mean? And what's the difference between a cafe radical and a radical? Final questions. Millions of civilians died under Stalin and Mao in pursuit, or at least ostensibly, of equality under communism. Can human equality ever be progressed through violence? What goals, other goals, might violence progress, if any? Well, there's a lot of food for thought in that story, listeners. So at any rate, this is Jeff signing off. Stay safe.